The first one is the importance of membership in the Vancouver Institute. Oh, now can you hear me? Is that better? Thanks, Peter. I'll try to speak louder. As you know, the lectures are free. The fact that they are free is in keeping with the tradition of the Vancouver Institute since its inception in 1916. One of the goals of the Institute is to encourage public education and discourse, and free of any financial barrier. However, the Institute does incur a number of expenses, and for that reason, we encourage you to take out a membership if you're able to do so. The membership fees continue to be very reasonable, $35 for a family, $25 for single memberships, and $10 for students. Becoming a member entitles you to seating in the lower part of the lecture hall if you get here before 8 o'clock. You can buy a membership after the lecture tonight at the table at the entrance to the lecture hall. I should also say that donations are warmly welcomed. If you do not have one, please pick up one of the brochures at the membership table, which gives you details about recognition of donors, as well as the capital fund for the Institute's 100th anniversary. Next Saturday, that is October the 3rd, the Institute's guest lecturer will be Dr. Charles Jenks. He's an architectural theorist, landscape architect, and designer from Dumfries, Scotland. At least that's where a garden that he's created, which is called the Garden of Cosmic Speculation, is located. The range of his creativity is quite remarkable, and recognition of some of the achievements of his is noted in the brochure. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Institute's format, the lecture will be about an hour, followed by a question period of about 15 minutes. And following the question period this evening, I will ask Dr. Vogt, a strong Institute supporter and director of Triumph for many years, to thank our speaker. There will be, after the lecture, tea and cookies. May I just remind you, could you please turn off cell phones, chiming watches, and so on before the lecture begins? Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Nigel Lockyer, the director of Triumph, Canada's National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics. He took his Bachelor of Science degree at York University and his PhD at Ohio State. In 1984, he began to teach physics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he stayed until he took up the position of the Director of Triumph in May of 2007. While at Pennsylvania University, his research was conducted with the CDF experiment at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in the Fermi Lab. His research focused on high-energy particle experiments with a strong interest in testing symmetries and on the study of the heaviest quarks, particularly the bottom quark. Dr. Lockyer has been described as a quark man. About that, he said, "My claim to fame was having measured the lifetime of a B quark, which I understand to be in the order of 1/1,000,000th of a second." In addition to his outstanding research, Dr. Lockyer has made many contributions to the advancement of science. For example, he's served on many Canadian scientific review committees, including the chairing the grant selection committee of NSERC in 2003 and the Canadian Foundation for Innovation Review in 2006. Tonight, Dr. Lockyer is going to speak to us on the topic of quarks, isotopes, and the future of subatomic particles. In case you think that doing research into what makes things tick at the smallest scale would produce a person with a narrow a quark geek, so to speak, have no fear. Dr. Lockyer ponders the universe or universes with excitement and wonder, and it's in a way that's infectious to others. I understand, for example, that when he was at the University of Pennsylvania, he taught a physics class with Tom Stoppard on Stoppard's play, Arcadia. Dr. Lockyer's scientific exactitude, along with his enthusiasm for scientific discovery, must be a boon for Triumph as it moves towards the ambitious and carefully crafted five-year plan that Dr. Lockyer has been instrumental in designing. To end on a rather frivolous note, Dr. Lockyer, quark geek or no, is not without a bit of whimsy. He drives a red Porsche. Please welcome our speaker.
Thank you. Now, was that applause for you or for me? Thank you very much for the Porsche. Yeah. So I had prepared a lecture for the University Neighborhood Association some time ago. The average age was between 7 and 10 years old. So, but I've heard that you're a sophisticated audience, so I've made it a little simpler than I did for for that audience. So I'm going to, you heard the title already, and the quarks, leptons, and isotopes are really just to tell you what the world is made out of, and I'm going to focus on the future of subatomic physics, and particle physics in particular, since I'm a particle physicist. But what I'd like to be able to get across to you is the way science proceeds, and what is the big question in my field. So science proceeds by asking questions. And then in order to answer those questions, you build something which I'm referring to as a tool. We'll call experiments tools. And those tools answer those questions, but once you've answered the questions, there's always more questions when you're finished. And so that's how the field evolves. And so I'm going to try and present particle physics to you that way. But the punchline, if you're, since you're only supposed to learn one thing from a lecture, is, you're smiling, I'm going to get into the Higgs boson. So you can relax, that's what it's really about, that's a disguise, the title's a disguise. Now, I don't want you looking at this screen because this comes later in my talk. So why is everybody looking at that screen right now? So this is I called this the Gaddafi tent when I came in. So the camel's inside. So there's a cloud chamber in there, and what you're actually seeing are the cosmic rays which are coming into this room in real time. It's not a movie. And when we're finished, or when I'm finished, you're welcome to come down here and have a look and a few inches away and see how it works. But I'll tell you how it works as we get into what I have to say. All right, so I've told you that science is characterized by questions. And I carefully chose the top 9 because I didn't want to sound like the top 10 questions. But I'm going to focus on the 2 where the arrows are pointed here. But the question is, are there laws of physics that we have yet to discover? And the answer is, of course, yes. We don't know everything. We're not completely arrogant in terms of our knowledge. Are there extra dimensions of space, small or large? Well, of course there are. We just haven't found them yet, especially the small ones. Do the forces become one? This is the question of, are the forces unified? This is Einstein's spent his life doing this. So I'm going to talk about this. Have we solved the mystery of dark matter and dark energy? You read about this all the time now. And the answer is, of course not. That's an outstanding question. Where is all of the antimatter? I'll spend a little time on that. What are the limits for building new isotopes? How many isotopes can you make? Can you engineer isotopes? How did the elements from iron to uranium originate? You know that hydrogen, helium, lithium were made in the Big Bang. And most of the elements up until iron were made in stars, that then is a furnace of making elements. But beyond that, that's the field of nuclear physics today. It's a hot topic. And people think it comes from stars exploding. So the question is, what causes stars to explode at the end of their life? And yet it's creating the birth of a new system. So one of the more interesting things I learned as a student was that our solar system was created from the remnants of a supernova in this area of our galaxy. And I always thought that was fantastic. And if that wasn't the case, we wouldn't be here. Finally, how do we combine quantum mechanics and gravity. That is, you could call that string theory if you're a string theory advocate. But that is, of course, one of the holy grails of particle physics nowadays. All right, remarkably, we have 99% in common with the chimpanzee, our genome. Chimps use sticks as tools for discovery. So we know that a chimp will pick up a stick, think about something, walk a quarter of a mile, take that stick, put it in a tree, pull out the bugs inside the tree, and eat them. And we'll know in advance that their finger couldn't do it. So the whole thing was thought through, and I would like you to think of that stick as a tool. That's the simplest tool. Now, Einstein had a tool also. Now, any of you that knows anything about general relativity will appreciate that Einstein's pencil was curved, and that gave him his idea for general relativity. That was a joke for those who didn't know. So Einstein's pencil is just a simple tool. And of course, the granting councils in Canada like scientists that only use pencils as tools, because there's experimentalists like we have nowadays who like to build humongous detectors. So this is the ATLAS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, Geneva, Switzerland. There's a man. These structures here are part of a toroidal coil that makes the magnetic field. This detector gets filled in. I call this whole thing a detector. It gets filled in with millions and millions of channels of sensors, which are then sent out to banks of computers more than you can imagine and analyzed. And ultimately, this thing is, well, it's more expensive than a pencil for sure. Perhaps $500 million for just what you're looking at. But the important thing is this humongous detector has been built to find something very small. And in the vernacular of the water fountain at the end of the hall discussion, it's been built to find the Higgs boson. So we're going to get into that. So I want you, the typical public lecture about the Higgs is superficial, and I'm going to try and make you become more than superficial. That's the goal tonight. You're going to learn a little more than you normally would learn in a lecture this way. And we'll see how successful we are. All right, so, but first of all, there's a warning for my lecture. And so this goes back to Confessions by St. Augustine in 400 AD. And it's a story about the curiosity about nature, which is a disease. There is another form of temptation even more fraught with danger. This is the disease of curiosity. It is this which drives us on to try to discover the secrets of nature, those secrets which are beyond our understanding, which can avail us nothing, and which men should not wish to learn. In this immense forest full of pitfalls and perils, I have drawn myself back and pulled myself away from these thorns. In the midst of all these things which float unceasingly around me in my everyday life, I am never surprised by any of them. And I'm never surprised by any of them, and I'm never captivated by my genuine desire to study them. I no longer dream of the stars. Now, I assume you would all like to have dinner with this person. And I found this on the wall of the funding agencies in Ottawa. They thought. All right, so I'm going to tell you very quickly what we're made out of. We are made out of molecules, and molecules are made out of atoms, and atoms are made out of electrons with a nucleus in the middle here, and then the nucleus is made out of protons and neutrons. This is the helium atom. If you look inside, these are the protons and neutrons inside the helium atom. That's the two electrons around the outside. And you see that the protons and neutrons are made out of quarks. So everything around you is a chemical element, and all the chemical elements are in a periodic table: hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, and so on. You start with one proton, you add a proton, you add another proton, and every time you add a proton, you add an electron. The algorithm is simple. The only flexibility we have is the number of neutrons. And that's where the word isotope enters into the picture. So for every element on this table, there's actually something that's coming out of the screen. That's the isotopes, where you vary the number of neutrons. So this says there's isotopes by the thousands. Now, you've probably read in the press about one isotope, Moly-99, the one we're short of, and that's on here somewhere. But there's thousands of isotopes here. The stable isotopes, and let's just call them atoms for now, are these black dots. This is the number of protons in the nucleus and the number of neutrons this way. The yellow region are the unstable ones. So there are nuclei which are unstable. They decay into something else. That's the yellow ones that have been studied. And then this green area are the ones that have never been studied. That's the main focus of the research at TRIUMF nowadays, is to understand this region that hasn't been studied. And as you move out here, it's nuclei with more and more neutrons, to the point where the nucleus is essentially all neutrons. And I show you here in the corner neutron stars, which are, of course, made out of neutrons. So an indirect way of studying neutron stars is to make nuclei that are made out of primarily neutrons. And that's the reason for the interest in this. But we're also interested in how many neutrons you can add until the nucleus just falls apart. That's called the limits of existence. And this line here, which you see is labeled the R process, is thought to be an important region in this chart that tells you how these chemical elements were made, the ones the world is made out of. So you have copper in your body, for example. You can't live without that copper. But we actually don't know how copper is made in the universe. It's thought to be made in a supernova explosion, but we don't know. And so that's the thrust of that area of research in nuclear physics. Now we can ask, how do we look inside the atom and how do we make isotopes? Well, the world's largest cyclotron is down the street. It's at TRIUMF. I'm going to refer to it as a big stick. It's a tool. It allows us to look inside the atom. It allows us to make isotopes for interesting experiments about neutron stars, for example. Now, I call this a primer. Some people say primer. I say primer. So I'm going to give you a subatomic physics primer quickly. What is a particle? It's a disturbance in an energy field. What is a field? Well, a temperature is a field. So I can assign a number to every point in space in this room, which would be the temperature. And so that collection of numbers representing the temperature in the room would be called a temperature field. It's defined everywhere in space. There's one number. Now, there's something called a vector field. That's a scalar field. There's just one number associated with it. There's a vector field, so that's like wind. So you would have a number that says 5 kilometers per hour, but it also has a direction, northeast. And again, every point in space would be defined by those two quantities. That's called a vector field. Now, a charged particle has an electric field associated with it, and that electric field would be a vector field. Now, I've told you I'm going to tell you about the Higgs, and it turns out the Higgs is a scalar field. You just save that for a while. So protons and neutrons are not elementary. I'm an elementary particle physicist, which means to me a proton is a big bag of garbage. It's full of quarks, it's full of gluons, it's a mess. Why would anybody work with those things? Well, that's what nuclear physicists do, but not particle physicists. And neutrons are the same thing. The world is made out of matter. These are matter particles here in the pink and the green. These are the quarks. These are the leptons. And you see, these particles are representing the force carriers. So I want you to think of the world as consisting of two quantities, matter and the stuff that holds that matter together. In this figure, It says, I've done it, I found it, the most basic particle. But this guy over here says, I found the particle that makes the most basic particle. So, all right, so we claim these are the smallest things in the universe. In fact, the quarks are thought to have no size. Well, obviously they must have some size, but the size that they're usually given is 10 to the minus 35 meters. That is small. But the resolution of that experiment in terms of distance or in size at the LHC, it's about 10 to the minus 18 meters. So there's that distance scale between 10 to the minus 18 and 10 to the minus 35, which is called the Planck length for the experts, that we really can't see experimentally. So there may be structure to quarks, and there's some foolish people looking for that. Not myself, of course. All right, so there's matter particles. So the entire world that you know is made up of up quarks and down quarks and electrons. That makes the atoms in the table of elements. And the neutrino, well, the neutrino's there, but we don't worry about it too much. At least I don't. The little balls next to it, the size of these balls represent the mass. So, yes, that's tiny. That's just barely above zero. And you can see these are fairly small. The quarks are a little heavier than the electron. And I think of the electron as an elementary particle. Its size, 10 to the minus 35 meters. The quarks, 10 to the minus 35 meters. So this is all we needed. However, there is what we call another family or another generation. So the up quark has a cousin, the charm quark. The down quark has a cousin, the strange quark. The electron neutrino has a cousin, the muon neutrino. And the electron has a cousin, the muon. Don't know why they're there, but they are there. And there's their masses. So you see the mass of this cousin is significantly larger than the electron. That's still a dot. I can't tell whether they're larger or not, and we don't know. This mass is larger than that, and that mass is larger than that, and that mass is larger than that is larger than that. Still, not clear why they're like that, but that's just a fact of life. Again, you don't know why you have two families, but there's in fact three families. So this is the top quark. This is the bottom quark, which you heard about in the introduction. And then this is the tau neutrino, and this is the tau. Now, these are called leptons, which means light. But you're going to see these are the masses. So this is the top quark. It's still a particle with no obvious structure. It's not like an atom. It's not like a proton. It has no structure. Yet it has the mass of a gold atom. It has the mass of 175 GeV in those units. So this is humongous. This is the mass of the bottom quark, bigger than all of those, and that's the mass of the tau. It's a lepton. In fact, it means light, but you can see that it's obviously heavier than the other quarks. So the ability to predict what was happening in mass was not there. Now, Sir Dennis Wilkinson, sitting in the front row, who gave his lecture in 1978, and when the top quark was discovered, it turns out the top quark decays into a W and a B, as I'm sure most of you are aware. And when that B travels a certain distance, a few hundred microns, it was detected with a detector that was read out with a circuit that was designed by Sir Dennis. And so I used that myself, in fact, in the experiment. So I was on the experiment that discovered the top quark. It behaves exactly as predicted. It looks like it's out of place in this picture, but it actually behaves as predicted. It gives us no clue as to what is the physics beyond what we already know, which is very bizarre in itself. So we talked about matter, now we talk about the forces of nature. There's four forces, and the question is, why are they so different? So we have gravity, which you're familiar with. We have the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force. This holds the quarks together, it holds the protons and neutrons together, and then there's the weak nuclear force, which is related to how the neutrino interacts, it's related to the decay of particles within the nucleus. Now, forces between particles, force, say, between one quark and the other quark, is mediated by a force carrier particle. So what you have here is, a negative charged particle, an electron, and a positive charged particle, the proton. So this could be the hydrogen atom. How does the electron stick to the nucleus in the hydrogen atom? Well, it's exchanging a photon. And what's interesting about that photon is it has zero mass. If I ask, how does the sun attach itself to the Earth, or how do you attach to the ground, that the force of gravity is thought to be explained by an exchange of a particle called a graviton, which also has zero mass. So the photon has zero mass, the graviton has zero mass. This is the force that holds the quarks together. It's what holds the proton together. It holds the neutron together. The gluon, or gluons, also have zero mass. But the weak nuclear force, in fact, these particles, the W and the Z, have mass. So they're special force carriers. So one question you can ask, which has been asked, is why is the weak interaction weak? Well, obviously it's weak because it's called the weak interaction. And the reason is, and I'm not going to give you the answer to this, you're just going to accept this and be happy and smile. And you were going to say, because the W and the Z acquire a mass. So this is Peter Higgs. He's now famous. Peter Higgs suggested how the W and Z could acquire a mass. He called it electroweak symmetry breaking. That sounds complicated, and it is. We, the rest of us, simply say particles acquire mass because of the Higgs boson. And in particular, the W and Z acquire mass because of the Higgs boson. And I'm going to explain that to you as we go along. So new tools are needed to find the particles. So now we come to the cloud chamber, which is over here. So the cloud chamber is a tool to see particles. Charles Wilson, this is Charles Wilson here, discovered the cloud chamber and was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work. He had the idea while working on Ben Nevis in 1894, so it tells you how old this technology is. The positron, which is the first antimatter particle discovered, was discovered by Carl Anderson using a cloud chamber. So that was the first antimatter particle in 1932. So what you're seeing here are, in fact, I have a slide that helps you understand this. So here is a particle coming into the top of the atmosphere. Let's call it a primary cosmic ray. So it could be coming from the sun, center of the galaxy, interstellar space, but nevertheless, it's raining on top of our atmosphere, and it strikes a nucleus in the atmosphere, and all these particles start raining down. And what we're seeing in this room, we're being radiated as we sit here by cosmic rays coming through the atmosphere and into the room. And this cloud chamber is showing you the activity in there, which is going to be the same as out there, because that's a very thin tent, by the way. So what you can see, that's an alpha particle. So that was a helium nucleus. If you see a long straight one like there, that was a most likely a muon. Remember, that's the cousin of the electron. And when you see a squiggly one, that's most likely that was an electron. That's an alpha particle. That's an electron. You can see how this is a little hypnotizing after a while. So you can come and see it afterwards. Now, it turns out that Charles Wilson was a meteorologist, interested in weather, and so people at one time actually thought cosmic rays may forecast the weather. They went up on top of mountains and they looked at them and tried to understand them. This is Millikan looking inside of, I think, an electroscope or something, looking at cosmic rays. So in the early days, people were not sure what was going on. I think it's clear now what they're going on, but there's still a field of research looking at cosmic rays. So here's a picture of what's effectively a cloud chamber in a magnetic field. So charged particles curve in a magnetic field. And so what I want you to do is think of something invisible coming in here. And now look at this, curl in. So this is the path of the particle inside this cloud, if you like. And then it stops there. And there's one that starts here and comes around and it stops there. This turns out to be an electron. And this turns out to be an anti-electron. So that's the positron. That's how antimatter was discovered. It's just by looking at a picture like this. And a lot of physics was discovered this way, including the early work associated with the weak interaction. So now you know antimatter exists. So now we'll talk about your favorite movie. Maybe not, I don't know. Favorite book, Dan Brown, Matter versus Antimatter. And there's your favorite movie star. I'm not sure which one you like best, the anti-Tom Hanks or Tom Hanks himself. Either way, they look very similar. At least they're supposed to look very similar. Now, if they were to meet, the anti-Tom Hanks was to meet the Tom Hanks, they would annihilate. And the amount of energy that came out of that collision would be the mass of Tom Hanks plus the mass of anti-Tom Hanks equals mc squared. That's a lot of energy. We wouldn't be here if that really happened. But that's a definition of antimatter. It annihilates. Interestingly, although the positron was the first antimatter particle found, the antiproton, which I told you is a big bag of stuff like the proton, the Nobel Prize was given to an experiment that didn't show that that it actually annihilated. There was enough confidence that the mass was identical that they gave the Nobel Prize. It was the subsequent experiment by a friend of mine that did not get the Nobel Prize that actually showed that they annihilated. So there is an antiproton. And it's a complicated object. So it's very interesting that nature does make not only antiparticles which are elementary, but it makes antiparticles which are not elementary, meaning the proton and the antiproton, the neutron and the antineutron. All right, so just a slight diversion into the Big Bang for a second. So 14 billion years ago, the Big Bang produced equal amounts of matter and antimatter. We call that particle democracy. That's why we live in a democracy. And here, we're talking about matter. Let's say 10 billion particles at the beginning of the universe and 10 billion antiparticles at the beginning of the universe. I think you know what you expect to happen now. All the matter should have annihilated with all the antimatter. I think I say here, all the matter should annihilate with all the matter, but actually the matter should annihilate with all the antimatter. But instead, it all annihilated except for one particle. So one in, let's say, a billion particles did not annihilate at the beginning of the universe. And that's what we're made out of, the leftovers. So the universe is full of photons, and for every particle, there's a billion photons out there. And since we can see those photons, this all makes some sense. There's always a few people who can find holes in every argument, but basically you're the leftovers. So antimatter has now progressed where we're going to call it a tool. Nuclear medicine doctors use positrons, which are anti-electrons, to image inside the body. That's positron electron emission tomography. After the anti-electron annihilates, then you have gamma rays that come out, and then the detector is just a fancy cloud chamber. The detectors are tools, and so is the antimatter, and so that's how the science is progressing.
Life sciences program.
1 minute.
Several radiopharmaceuticals are prepared at Trion, and their chemical structures are shown here. These drugs act at the synaptic junction of the nerve terminals in the brain. The radioactive drugs are injected intravenously and then travel through the patient's bloodstream.
Do you like the music?
These drugs travel to various organs, and in our case, we look at the uptake in the brain. In the body, these PET isotopes decay by positron emission. The positrons annihilate with electrons, to produce high-energy gamma rays that are detected by the tomographic scanner. These PET isotopes are produced by the cyclotron shown earlier. PET can also be used in the detection of cancer. At Triumph, we are now producing enough FDG from the BC Cancer Agency to carry out 15 patient scans each day. We are also using therapeutic isotopes that can be linked to large molecules, such as antibodies, for use in tumor cell killing studies. These isotopes, attached to antibodies, act by breaking DNA bonds.
Antimatter is everywhere. Our bodies emit 400 positrons per second. How many knew that? Eric, very good. You get an A in the course. Bananas contain potassium. This is a banana. Bananas contain potassium. There are 24 isotopes of potassium, three naturally occurring. Potassium 39 is most of the potassium, but potassium 40 has a half-life of 1.25 billion years. We ingest radioactive potassium from bananas, and that gives one positron per second. I made this especially for Jennifer. One avocado is equal to two bananas. Now, I'm not suggesting that the grocery store should start comparing the relative quality of their fruit with the number of antimatter particle decays, but it is gives you something to think about next time you have a salad. All right, so back to the Higgs boson. There's Peter Higgs. So now we're going to talk about the unification of the four forces. So up here I say, we believe that there was just one force after the Big Bang. As the universe cooled down, that single force split into the four we know today. So there's the Big Bang, and there's the lifetime of the universe. We're living out here, the four forces. We start here with one force. The four forces are gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear forces. There are similar mathematical laws which describe three of the forces, but not gravity. Gravity is just hard to handle. At the TeV scale, meaning here, electromagnetism and the weak forces unify. So you can see this is electromagnetic force. This is the weak nuclear force. Comes together, and there's one. The strong interaction is thought to be unified at what's called the gut scale, which is here. And gravity unifies at the Planck scale. But the way the real world works is the other way. So it started here, breaks apart, breaks here, breaks here. This is where we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. It's where the electroweak force breaks into the electromagnetic and the weak force. And it's going to be the Higgs boson or the Higgs field that's responsible for the actual breaking apart at that point. And you'll understand it a little better in a second. So we need a tool to explore the beginning of the universe. So this is the beginning, and then it moves to your right. 13.7 billion years, give or take a billion years. We live out here, and this is the very beginning. The time that we're interested in talking about for where the electroweak force breaks into the electromagnetic and weak force is 10 to the minus 12 seconds after the Big Bang. So we're talking about 1 trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, something interesting happens. Now, where does the Big Bang start? Well, usually we talk about the Planck time as the earliest time in the universe. So at 10 to the minus 44 seconds, something happens. The universe progresses. And at 10 to the minus 12, that's where we are experimentally. That's where the LHC is. So we think we're studying 10 to the minus 12 seconds after the beginning of the universe at the LHC. That's the LHC in Switzerland. That's inside the tunnel. 27 kilometers of superconducting magnets. There's a something made in Canada sign here. We made a section of the accelerator designed to Triumph. The magnets were actually made in Quebec. I just want to tell you how much the technology of accelerators has progressed. So the one on the left is the original Lawrence cyclotron. I've told you that the cyclotron at Triumph is the largest in the world. This is the original one. You can hold it in your hand. It's 13 centimeters in diameter. The LHC is 9 kilometers in diameter. So that ratio is 69,000. So we now make an instrument that's 69,000 times larger than the original cyclotron. The ratio of the energies of the two accelerators is 175 million. So the progress in accelerator technology is certainly impressive. This is the inside of the Atlas detector. There are the Canadian components that were built, the Triumph. And I'd like you to think of the Atlas detector as a big, it's certainly big, fast, high-resolution camera. It takes 40 million pictures per second. So the camera you buy from Canadian Tire, I don't know where you get your camera, takes maybe one picture per second. This detector takes 40 million pictures per second. And the amount of data that is stored after 1 year, this is a stack of CDs 20 kilometers high. So the units of data storage on your PC is gigabytes. If you multiply 1,000, it's terabytes. If you multiply by 1,000,000, it's petabytes. So the LHC makes petabytes of data per year to analyze. So it's a huge amount of data. Some significant fraction of that is stored here in Canada at Triumph, for your information. Another short movie. Can you turn the volume up? That's Roy Langstaff from Triumph.
The truck has 128 wheels and hydraulic jacks to keep the load perfectly level so the heavy wheels don't slide along their axis and crash out of the cryostat. The Atlas detector is one of the eyes of the LHC microscope. Its job is to detect and identify the subatomic particles that come spewing out of the proton-proton collisions. The Atlas detector is 25 meters tall, 46 meters long, and weighs about 7,000 tons. It cost $500 million to build. It can detect all kinds of particles coming out of the collisions, measure their charges and energy and directions, and piece together the jigsaw puzzle of what happens in the instant after the protons collide.
Keep an eye here.
It lets us reconstruct the exotic ephemeral particles which exist briefly and then decay to standard model. Here's a physicist heading up to show us the Canadian NCAPs. Fortunately, he seems to have come from Vancouver and has brought his climbing gear with him. This would be a pretty cold climb as the calorimeter runs at 84 Kelvin or about minus 189 Celsius.
All right, now let's continue. So symmetry in art. Here's a picture of Escher. Everybody knows what symmetry in art means. But symmetry in physics is a little bit different. And so I want you to just think a little bit about this next slide. So spontaneous symmetry breaking is the term that's used to talk about when we go from one phase of matter to another. So steam has hot perfect symmetry. What we mean by that is if you're inside the steam and you look in any direction, you can't tell which direction you're looking in. It's a perfect symmetry. Now, usually you would say a snowflake is highly symmetric. But to a physicist, a snowflake is a broken symmetry. You've gone from this perfect steam symmetry to something where if you just rotate the snowflake a little bit, you know you've rotated it because the point, one point is different, pointing in a different direction. So symmetry breaking turns out to be an important concept in physics. Another example down here is iron. So below some critical temperature, iron becomes magnetic because the magnetic moment of the iron atoms align. And above that temperature, the spins are not aligned, which is the state of greater symmetry. All right, now you're going to see a movie of me here. So you were correct in calling me a geek. I made my own demo here for you guys.
The apparatus you see here is a horseshoe magnet with a north pole and a south pole. Every magnet has a north pole and a south pole. And as you all know, there's a magnetic field here where the lines of force travel from one pole to the other pole in a shape not unlike the U itself. As I bring it closer, I can feel it pulling on my fingers, and then eventually it sticks. Now what happens, actually, is that the iron atoms in this nail become aligned with the magnetic field. You can think of this nail, once it's been in the magnetic field, as a bar magnet with a north pole and a south pole. And it remains a bar magnet as long as the iron atoms inside and the little clusters of iron atoms are aligned in the same direction. Now if I heat this nail up, those atoms tend to be oriented in random directions and it will lose this property of behaving like a small bar magnet. And that's what I'd like to demonstrate.
Clear? Perfectly clear? No? We can come back to it. All right, so the Higgs field is a scalar field. I told you that. There's a number everywhere in space. It fills the entire universe. Particles traveling through the universe interact with this field and become massive. Importantly, the W and the Z bosons, which are the particles which are the force carriers of the weak interaction, receive mass, but the photon doesn't. Remember, the photon was the particle that was the carrier of the electromagnetic force between two charges. It's still neutral in the standard model, and that was the great prediction of the standard model, that the W and the Z would have mass, and the photon would be massless. And the Nobel Prize was given for that. Okay, so this helps illustrate a little bit. On the left, you have the electron just traveling straight through, unimpeded. There's no Higgs field. The Z and W travel straight through, and the top quark travels straight through. On the right, there is a Higgs field, and now the particles have to interact with that field as they go through. So if you think about the analogy to a magnetic field, when you have the nail in your hand and you push it through the magnetic field, you feel the resistance on your hands. When you push an object like this here, I feel a resistance because it has mass. So it's the same kind of idea that I'm having to move this through a Higgs field. And this mass is interacting with that Higgs field. So I need my muscle to move it. If this was massless, I wouldn't need it, because a massless object doesn't interact with the Higgs field. All right, so now I'm going to give you what's called a quasi-political explanation of the Higgs boson. So Mr. Waldegrave was the UK science minister in 1993, and a friend of mine, David Miller, came up with these pictures. So this is a room full of politicians having a drink at the end of the day. I guess that's what they do. And they're interacting with one another. So that's like the Higgs boson, the Higgs field. So at every point in space in this room, there's a politician that corresponds to a point, let's say, that represents the Higgs field. Now, a famous person enters the room. Has to be a famous politician. It looks like Einstein, I know, but it has to be a famous... Who's the UK politician that looks like that, Sir Dennis? Do you know? Margaret Thatcher, maybe. So Margaret Thatcher comes in the room, and all of these politicians pay attention, and she wants to walk through the room. Well, they grab her, and they want to talk to her and get the latest information. And that is representing the fact that Margaret Thatcher gains mass moving through this room. Or, said another way, a particle gains mass moving through the Higgs field. The politicians are the Higgs field. Margaret Thatcher is the particle. Now, this is another example, because you've heard the word field, and then there's the word the particle itself. So the person on the left is shouting a rumor that there's going to be an election. Needless to say, they're interested. But it's only a rumor. I could say it's a scandal. Politicians have scandals as well, I suppose. But then they start talking to one another because of that rumor. So the field people cluster together. That's the Higgs boson. So when the field is just scattered around, that's the Higgs field. And when it collects together, it's a particle. So when we say the Higgs boson is what we're looking for, we're actually looking for a clustering of the Higgs field at the LHC. So what's next? Discovery of the century. You see what looks like the tip of a pyramid there. These guys are looking pretty serious. And they're wondering whether that's the Higgs boson. Well, we don't know. But the interesting question is, and there's books written on this, is will the Higgs boson, if it's discovered, of course it'll be discovered, I guarantee you it'll be discovered, will it become a tool? Will we use it for something? So this is the particle that gives mass to other particles. So if you think about the amount of energy that's stored inside a single particle, and you actually understood how that works, could you use it for something? That's the challenge for the engineers. The physicists, they're just happy to have found it. That's the end of my story. Thank you. Merci.
Dr. Locke here will take questions now.
Chalk River is having some trouble producing radio isotopes for medical research. I think you were quoted in the paper as saying that maybe Triumph might think of doing something. Can it do anything?
Right. So the question is, I'm supposed to repeat the question. Question is, Chalk River is having problems producing Moly 99, the medical isotope that's 80% of all nuclear medicine procedures use Moly 99. Canada produces about half the world's supply of that isotope, and it's made in the NRU reactor in Chalk River. And that reactor was built just after the end of the Second World War. It's 50 years old, maybe a little older. And it's had continuing problems. So at the moment, it's not working. So there's a shortage. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? The Triumph makes isotopes with accelerators now, but it does not make Moly 99. But it is possible to make Moly 99 with accelerators. And there's several possible ways of doing it. And so we usually break it up into a short-term, medium-term, and a longer-term discussion. So a possible short-term solution proposed by a member in the audience here, Tom Ruth, with Francois Bernard and friends at BC Cancer, is to use the existing cyclotrons that are in the major medical centers. These are Triumph-designed cyclotrons, but many of them were built here in Vancouver. To use those with a special target, Moly 100, and you can make Moly 99 from that, enough for the local medical center. So that's a proposal that's into CIHR now. For the medium-term solution, we're proposing that you build an electron accelerator that uses a process called photofission. Photofission uses a photon to split the nucleus rather than a neutron. The NRU uses a neutron. We're proposing to use a photon, and we should be able to make the exact same purity of Moly 99 and enough for Canada. It's not really intended to make enough for the world. You'd have to build more accelerators. And so we've proposed that particular solution to Natural Resources Canada. It has the advantage that it doesn't use weapons-grade uranium, which is one of the drawbacks. U-235 is what's used in the reactor. We get it from the U.S. It's a proliferation issue, which makes people unhappy. So we would just use natural uranium. Sure. So dark matter is something... What is dark matter and what is dark energy? Could you make a few comments? So dark matter is thought to be a particle. And so its importance is perhaps in coalescing the galaxies at the beginning of the universe. You can the so-called light curves associated with the rotation velocity of a star around the galaxies indicate that they are deviating from what you would expect from Newton's laws. And so there's a number of approaches to that. There's experiments at Snow Lab in Sudbury, Ontario, which will be looking directly for those. There's experiments in Europe to do that. And the basic idea is that these are weakly interacting massive particles which would penetrate the Earth. We're moving through them all the time in space. They're in our galaxy. And they would be something we would be able to detect. We also think there's something we can make at the LHC. And so it turns out if you put in all the numbers and... estimate the mass of these particles, they're right in the energy range that you would produce them at the LHC. So dark matter is something that's mysterious, but it's not too far out of our reach, let's say. Dark energy comes from observations that the certain types of supernova, which are treated as standard candles, when you look at their brightness as a function of distance, the most distant ones appear to be accelerating away from us. And so it appears as though the universe is accelerating rather than attracting back together again, which is what you would expect just from simple gravity. There is no understanding of that. I think the people think that it could be a form of repulsive gravity for example. The only field we know which should permeate the universe in the way I've described is the Higgs field. But dark matter, there's no way of predicting it. Our calculational abilities in, let's say, quantum field theory are very poor. And so it's a total mystery, not understood. And the vast majority of energy of the universe seems to be in this material, but stay tuned. You know, it's big efforts in terms of satellites and so on to try and understand when we went from a universe that was slowing down to a universe that's now speeding up. And that's roughly halfway point. So somewhere around 7 billion years into the universe, it starts speeding up again. And if you know anything about inflation, the early part of the universe, the inflationary period, that was a period when, right at the earliest part of the universe, it started expanding very quickly, superluminal speeds. And inflation is thought to come from a scalar field. There are no scalar fields observed. The Higgs would be the first fundamental scalar field we find. So to me, that's why it's exciting, because we have all these theories beyond our standard model which describe new physics, and they all involve scalar fields of some kind, but we've never seen a scalar field. So if you find a Higgs field, you would at least say nature knows how to make a scalar field, and then these other theories about the early universe would start to take some reality from that. Oh, physicists, that's scary. Go ahead. November, this November. So as you know, the LHC turned on last year, and they sent beams in one direction, and then they sent beams in the other direction, and there was a big celebration, and it was looking great, and we had parties, and then they tried to ramp up the magnets to the higher energy, and one of the connections between two of the magnets, I guess, wasn't as good as it needed to be, and so there was one of the superconducting magnets went normal, and the helium got into the vacuum, and it blew up 100 magnets, so it's a mess, and it took a year to clean it up, and so now they're about to turn it on again, and you got to keep your fingers crossed, but probably that won't be the problem, it'll be something else, but the plan is to start in November and take data at I guess it's a little less than half the energy it's designed for 6 months. So you run till next summer, and then the rest of the year at 5 TeV. So should be exciting, but not enough to find the Higgs. And then they're going to go down for a year because they need to polish it or whatever they want to do. And so 2012 will be the big year. Yes. I heard everything but the question. So you said that there's inertial mass and gravitational mass, and they are equivalent, correct? Yes, and also inertial mass. Yes. The question is, if you find the Higgs, will it tell you something about gravity itself and how quantum mechanics and gravity comes together? I think the simple answer is no. What I do think it does, and part of what I was going to tell you was about the accelerator after the Large Hadron Collider, because that's my secret love. That's the International Linear Collider. So that's a 30-kilometer-long linear accelerator, would be built to study the Higgs boson. And the purpose of studying it would be to understand its properties in detail. And What you would get from that, as I said, it would be the only scalar field that's been observed. You might learn something about whether that has... scalar fields should couple to other scalar fields. So let me just make a bold statement. All new physics models beyond the standard model involve scalar fields. I gave you an example. The inflationary period of the universe is driven by something called the inflaton, which is a scalar field. It is possible, and I only say possible because you really don't know, that the Higgs mixes with the inflaton. And you could learn about these other scalar fields by studying the Higgs in detail. It's not obvious to me it tells you anything about gravity, though. I'll think about it some more, but I don't think so. Yes. For string theory? Yeah, so... Yes, the question is, can the LHC provide any empirical evidence for string theory? So remember, string theory is it's sold as the ultimate theory. It combines all the forces together, including gravity. And that's what's attractive about it, because there is really no other way of bringing everything, all the forces together under one umbrella. The best I can do there is there's something called supersymmetry. And supersymmetry is a new symmetry of nature that says for every... we never talked about the intrinsic angular momentum of particles, but it's called spin. So an electron has a spin 1/2. The W and the Z has a spin 1. So the world is grouped into what are called fermions, half-integer spin particles, and integer spin particles are called bosons. So the Higgs boson is spin 0. So that's why it's called a boson. So there's fermions and bosons. Supersymmetry says for every fermion, there has to be a partner boson. And for every boson, there has to be a partner fermion. That would double the number of particles. That's okay. We doubled the number of particles when we discovered antimatter. So that's happened before. It's not the first time. Supersymmetry appears, and I'm not a string theorist, so I'll poetic license here. It appears that string theory has supersymmetry embedded in it. And so what you hear is that if you were to find supersymmetry, the string theorist would sit up and pay attention. Let's put it that way. That would be a very positive signal. You're never going to see the string because of the size of it. Remember, it's probably 10 to the minus 35 meters, and you're probing with a resolution of 10 to the minus 18 meters. You're just not even close to seeing the structure of space at that point. Yes? Right. What's the probable cause of CP violation? Well, first of all, C is charge conjugation and P is parity, and CP is the product of those two symmetries. They're discrete symmetries. Charge conjugation changes a particle into an antiparticle. These are mathematical operations, and the parity operation reflects something in a mirror. So, and it's the product of those two. What happens is CP violation is a ingredient of the standard model. And how do I explain this simply? So the Nobel Prize this year was given to two Japanese physicists, Kobayashi and Maskawa, for something that's called the CKM matrix. Notice I added a C to the K and the M. That's Kabibo. But K&M got the Nobel Prize. That matrix is a 3x3 matrix, and it contains something called a complex phase. And that complex phase enters into the mathematics, if you like. If you know what a Lagrangian is, it's the equation that describes the interactions. And when you have a complex phase, The matter and antimatter are not treated the same. So at the moment in the standard model, those parameters, which do not, they explain CP violation in particle physics, but not in the universe. They're far short of what you get in the universe. Those parameters are inserted into the model. So nobody knows where they come from. I read a book once which said, suppose that parameter is called the phase of the CKM matrix. Think of it as a number. Suppose that was just came in at the beginning of the universe and our particular universe gave it its particular value. We'll never know anything. So that's the depressing story. The more ambitious physicists say that's just too, we can't be that unlucky. We have to understand everything. And so eventually we will understand the parameters that enter the standard model. So just quickly, the standard model describes everything we know about the experiments we've made with the strong interaction, the electroweak interaction. And the model requires roughly 23 numbers put into it. But those numbers came from measurements. So you've got a model, it requires input, but once you have that input, it does a great job. But we don't know where those numbers came from. And that's the reason we know there's new physics out there, is because it's very unsatisfactory to have to put numbers into a model. That makes physicists unhappy. Yes?
What is your opinion of the many universes conjecture?
Of the many universes conjecture? What is my opinion of the many universes conjecture? I like it. Again, it goes back to string theory and being able to solve the what I call the Lagrangian of the universe. There's one equation which describes everything, the theory of everything, but there's many, many solutions. One always hoped that you would find the right solution that describes our universe, and then we'd be done, and then we would have the answer. But in fact, there's many, many solutions. In fact, there's 10 to the 500 solutions. So some people postulate that there's a universe for every one of those solutions. Now that number is so big you can't even deal with it in a modern computer. So if you do calculations on a computer, you're always using random number generators, which are interesting things. And so you can imagine the 23 parameters I just described to you, which define our universe, as being all random numbers. And so to get our universe, they have to come out right. In other words, the strength of gravity has to come out right in our universe. Newton's constant. You often hear that if Newton's constant was a bigger number than when the Big Bang took place, it would collapse immediately. You'd have no universe. And if Newton's constant was smaller or weaker, then the universe would just blow itself apart and you'd never create the galaxies. So Newton's constant happens to be just the perfect number. Thank goodness we're here. So all of the parameters by definition are that way because you can point to some piece of physics where those parameters are important and that value of the parameter is needed in order for our universe to be here. So those You can think of it as I almost think of it as a slot machine. You pull a slot machine, all the numbers come up, the 23 numbers. That's a universe. And then you do it again, you make another universe. And all those universes are made, and there's one like ours, we're in it. There's one that's very similar to ours, maybe one of those numbers is just a little bit off. But when you have 10 to the 500 options, you're going to have a whole range of worthless universes. But you're going to have a few that might be interesting. Now, are we causally connected to those? That's another discussion.
I think we've got time for one more question. Yes?
All of this is predicated upon a closed universe, right? That nothing, no more matter, no additional matter or energy come into the universe.
No. 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 We don't, for example. Now, we don't know that it's a closed universe, nor do we know, for example, where the energy comes from in our universe. So let me give you an example. Somebody asked about dark energy earlier. We don't actually know where dark energy comes from. We don't know what's powering that. Is it coming from somewhere else, or is it there? You don't know. So there are things we don't know, actually. I know it's surprising, but... it doesn't fall apart for me. It's just it's the open universe.